This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. From the launch your online shop stage, all the way to the we just hit a million orders stage. No matter what stage you're in, Shopify's there to help you grow. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/special offer, all lowercase. That's shopify.com/special.
At Evernorth Health Services, we believe costs shouldn't get in the way of life-changing care. And we're doing everything in our power to make it possible. Behavioral health solutions that also keep your projections at their best? It's possible. Pharmacy benefits that benefit your bottom line? It's possible. Complex specialty care that cares about your ROI? It's possible. Because we're already doing it. All while saving businesses billions. That's Wonder made possible. Learn more at evernorth.com/wonder.
Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the editor of the New Books Network. NBN listeners like to read books and buy them. So we thought we'd tell you that right now, our friends at Princeton University Press are having a remarkable site-wide sale. You can get 50% off books, including ebooks and audiobooks, with the code 50, F-I-F-T-Y, at checkout until May 31. You can save some real money on Princeton University Press books. I encourage you to go there and check it out.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast. I'm your host, Crawford Gribben, and today my guest is Whitney G. Gamble. Whitney is a professor at Providence Christian College in Pasadena, California, and we're going to be talking to Whitney about her new book, Christ and the Law, Antinomianism at the Westminster Assembly, recently published by Reformation Heritage Books in 2018. Whitney, congratulations on the book, and welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
Well, it's great. It's great that you can be here. Before we begin talking about the book, could you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Yes. So I am, as you mentioned, a professor at Providence Christian College in Pasadena, and I teach biblical and theological studies there and historical theology as well. I have been teaching there for about 4 years. And before that, I taught on the East Coast. I'm from the East Coast of the States originally. And I got my PhD in Edinburgh, Scotland. And I've been working in the area of theology for a number of years. So,
very good. So you've written this really quite compelling and extremely important book about a subject that none of us really knew anything about up until this point. Can you tell us about how you came to choose that particular topic?
Yes, sure. It is rather an obscure topic. The book came out of my PhD studies originally. So I came to Edinburgh to work with Susan Hardman Moore there. And originally I was planning to work on the Puritan theologian John Owen and some of the theological controversies that surrounded him. And as I began my research, I needed to set the stage, set the context for Owen and his debates. And as I kind of delved into the theological world of London in the 1640s and 50s, I came upon I came upon minutes of this group, the Westminster Assembly, which is what my book is based on, came upon minutes that had been transcribed, included in Chad Van Dixhorn's PhD thesis from Cambridge University. And as I was reading them, kind of looking for any information relating to setting the context for my work on John Owen, I realized that there was information about this rather obscure controversy that wasn't reflected in secondary literature. So I kind of switched gears and started focusing more on the Westminster Assembly, more on their debates, and came out with a full fully formed PhD. So but it is a rather obscure topic, I think, if outside of the circles of Reformed theology. The Westminster Assembly is a very it was an important group for its time and its setting, very important group, but it has in one sense fallen by the wayside a little bit in today's studies, although it's receiving a renewal with the work of Chad Van Dixhorn and others, transcribing minutes that previously hadn't been available. So it is experiencing a bit of a renewal today, which is exciting.
Absolutely. I think you're very modest about your achievements, Whitney. It may be an obscure debate, but what your book does is to show how a theological debate at what becomes the most important Protestant council of the 17th century, certainly within Britain and Ireland, actually has far-reaching social and political ramifications. And I think you can capture that beautifully. And it's something that will appeal to readers from far outside of an historical, theological, scholarly bias. Can you tell us a little bit about the Westminster Assembly itself? What was it for? When was it set up? And also, could you tell us about how it's been represented in scholarship up to this point, where I think the burden of explanation has been placed upon the debates about church government that happened in that body?
Mm-hmm. Yes. So the Westminster Assembly was a religious committee of the Long Parliament. So it was called in 1643, and Parliament called the committee basically to advise Parliament on religious affairs of the nation. And this is why the connection to the politics and the history and everything that was going on in England and Great Britain as a whole tie in so well with the work of the Westminster Assembly, because it is a parliamentary group gathering. But it was a gathering of theologians, ministers, and professors, and their task, Parliament gave them the task to revise the, I guess, foundational documents of the Church of England at the time, well, and today, the 39 Articles. And Parliament had come to the decision that the documents weren't reformed enough. They wanted them to be, in Parliament's mind, more faithful to the Word of God than they were. And so they called these theologians to gather in London, come from all areas of England, and come together and spend time going through each article, revising it, editing it, making it more theologically accurate. And as well, they wanted the assembly to advise Parliament on any other issues theologically, religiously, that were going on in the nation at the time. So the assembly was very active. So they're revising theological documents. As time goes on, they actually abandon the 39 Articles to create their own confession of faith, again, directly related to political events. So Parliament decided to call on the help of the Scots and in the Civil War that they were fighting, and part of the agreement that they established with the Scottish authorities at the time was basically to create a new confession of faith that would be used in Scotland, in England, and in Wales as well. So the assembly kind of abruptly was ordered by Parliament to stop working on the 39 Articles and begin writing a new confession of faith. And it's that confession that they ended up, after years of work, that they ended up publishing that has endured throughout time, and with Presbyterian churches in Scotland and in North America and in Ireland and Northern Ireland as well. It's that confession that has endured, and it's typically people who subscribe to that confession that have historically done work on the Westminster Assembly. In the past, they have been the ones to really carry the research on the Westminster Assembly. I think, and they have, as you mentioned, focused more heavily on the debates concerning church government. That's what they've focused on, because there were extensive debates on church government at the Westminster Assembly. But I think as time has gone on, and with new research that's been coming out, we realized that, oh, well, there were many theological debates that were going on. There was multifaceted issues at the assembly, and we're just now kind of uncovering those issues and beginning to write on them more, as well as bringing in more of the political, historical elements as well to the assembly. So it's an exciting time for research on this area. And so yes, maybe obscure debates, but yes, very important for the history of theological development in Great Britain, in North America, and really throughout the world with the spread of Presbyterianism. So,
and your book makes that case with really quite brilliant clarity. That helps us with one part of the subtitle, Westminster Assembly. Help us with the other part of the subtitle, Antinomianism. So your book captures this moment in 1642, 1643, when the censorship of the press suddenly collapses. And there's a sudden outpouring of popular writing, some of it much less theologically informed than the rest. And within this surge of popular theology, there is this spectre of antinomianism that haunts the divines at Westminster. What is antinomianism, and why did it scare them so much?
Yes, that is kind of the million-dollar question for this book. antinomianism was almost hard to define because it was an underground movement, as you referenced, until 1642, when antinomian writings started to become published. But it's a movement from within the reformed strain of Puritanism. So a movement that was very much in line with many aspects of what we maybe call mainstream Puritanism. But it was, in the minds of the Westminster Assembly, a very dangerous movement, particularly because of the movement's understanding of the law. So its name, antinomianism, so anti against nomos, word for law. And one very important aspect of antinomianism was the belief that the law, and specifically the moral law, which for the divines at this time meant the Ten Commandments pretty much, the moral law no longer bound believers, or no longer were things that believers would have to be called to keep once they became a Christian, or once they received the Holy Spirit, they no longer were bound to keep the moral law. And for the divines, the Westminster Assembly, this was a very dangerous view, because, well, among a number of reasons, one would be they were afraid of anarchy. If you have this group that's quite popular, actually extremely popular, especially in London, it's an underground movement, but gaining popularity. People are flocking to hear antinomian preachers preach. And in the words of one assembly member, women especially are going to hear this group preach. And it's so popular that if one of the teachings is that the moral law no longer applies, well, then how are we going to enjoin people to keep a moral life? Is anarchy going to break out? Are people just going to begin kind of doing whatever they want? So that was one concern. Besides some of the more complex theological implications of the teaching as well. So that's antinomianism kind of in a nutshell. But yes, it for the assembly, it was in their mind, the most important, theological error, I guess, that was plaguing England, actually even more important to fight against than Catholicism, and Arminianism. So that was something that in my research I found to be a little surprising, because typically you think, oh, who are the theological bad guys during this time? And it's the Catholics or the Arminians. But actually for the assembly, it was more than anything else, the antinomians. So
fascinating. One of the things that really struck me about the early chapters of the book in particular is the diversity that's within the antinomian threat. You've got Church of England, Church of England ministers like John Eaton or Crisp. Later on in the 1630s, 1640s, people like John Simpson emerge, who is, for want of a better word, a Congregationalist slash Baptist, who forms or begins to lead what we would call an apocalyptic new religious movement, the Fifth Monarchists. And in his, I mean, his position seems especially complicated because on the one hand, you argue he's pushing for antinomianism in terms of personal ethics. The individual believer is not bound by the law. But yet the position of the movement he leads, the political vision of the movement he leads, is for theocracy. They want the nation to be brought under God's law. So with all this diversity, how much of a center is there to antinomianism in the 1630s, 40s?
That's a great question. And I think that was the question that the assembly was trying to get at, actually. So they're alerted to this dangerous thread of theological thinking, but they, as a whole, actually weren't at first clear on what this group actually represented. What were the teachings of antinomianism? Was it a common, were there common tenets that you could say all antinomians held to? So what the assembly started with was calling a number of quote-unquote antinomian, alleged antinomian ministers to the assembly and for an examination. And Simpson was one of them. And so I would argue that probably early on in the 30s, there wasn't necessarily a central core. I think it was developed underground. I think you can make the case there was one kind of earliest teacher, John Eaton, and he, in his number of pages of writing, his sermons that do get published, you can begin to draw out themes. And he was so influential that he did influence the next generation of men like Crisp and Simpson, so that by the time the 1650s roll around, there is a common set of beliefs. But at the same time, it was such a diverse group. But I think at the core, each alleged antinomian did hold to some belief that the law no longer applied to the believer. So that really is the core of their beliefs. And then from there, yes, great diversity as far as how that belief actually impacted then their other views, their political views, their views on church government, their views on baptism even. It's an interesting group to grasp. And David Como, a number of years ago, did a wonderful book that kind of traced the earliest strains of the antinomian movement as well. So
how well or how accurately can we understand this group as a group that's especially interested in Martin Luther?
Yes, Luther is quoted more than any other theologian, actually, in antinomian writings.
And why is that?
I think it comes down to Luther's understanding of the law, and particularly Luther's work in Galatians. His Galatians commentary is cited by John Eaton more than any other work. It's included on the front published page of Eaton's big antinomian work. And I think Luther's understanding of the freedom of the Christian from the law was really what drove the antinomian spirit. And for Luther, he wrote against Catholicism or strains within the church. I mean, arguably legalistic strains within the church. And I think for the antinomian, Luther's spirit of freedom was very appealing. And he is their hero, starting from John Eaton, definitely, and then continuing on through even the next generation as well. So
how did the divines of the Westminster Assembly respond to this? They bring in several antinomian preachers. They examine them. They try to find a common center or perhaps some shared theological themes. Once they've got that body of information, what do they do next?
So they debate what to do, like any good committee of parliament. They have some pretty spirited debates what to do with the result of their examination. And there's actually disagreement within the assembly. Parliament wants the assembly to make a judgment on antinomians. Are they heretical? Are they just misguided? Do they need to be instructed? Further, you know, receive further theological training, and members of the assembly are divided. Some think hands down that they're heretical, and Parliament should be alerted that this group is a heretical group, and they should receive the concomitant punishment that Parliament would mete out for heretical groups. Others say, no, they are merely misguided. They just need to be instructed further. And we should treat them as brothers in Christ and instruct them and hope for, I guess, the best in them kind of learning more about what true theology is. So they do end up after quite, heated debate, they do end up submitting their judgment to Parliament, and they say it's antinomianism isn't a heretical group. They are in error. They err in many important points of theology, but they are not heretical. So they submit that petition to Parliament in 1644, and after that, really, antinomianism, as far as the assembly is concerned, it's not brought up again. So I think in the mind of the assembly, it did its duty by informing Parliament about what antinomianism is. And then antinomianism is almost completely dropped from the minutes from that point on, which is interesting. So it really was a very heated, intense, but short amount of time in relation to the whole length of the assembly's years of meeting. It really was only an issue that they were concerned about for the first year of their meeting. So
is there any sense in your research that members of the assembly begin to worry that other members of the assembly are possibly heading in an antinomian direction? I'm thinking in particular of the debate they have about imputation in justification, for example.
Yes, that was a major concern. So in the book, in the second half of the book, it's more concerned with some of the pretty complex theological debates that the assembly had in relation to concerns that antinomian theology raised. And as you mentioned, one was about the imputation of Christ's righteousness, his work to the believer, specifically his work of keeping the law. How is that applied to the believer? And in those debates, the assembly is divided, and some members even accuse other members of espousing antinomian beliefs. So it does get pretty heated on the floor of the assembly. And I don't think that they necessarily truly believed that person was actually an antinomian, but I think they were concerned that, well, if you hold to your position that Christ's righteousness is imputed to the believer, well, then what is keeping you from becoming an antinomian? And so it was raised more in that spirit, but certainly, I think there was a fear that, well, we have to define what is happening with the work of Christ. And if we aren't careful, it could lead down, in their minds, a very dangerous path towards antinomianism.
So at the beginning of the assembly, 1643, antinomianism is something out there. It's an external threat. Later on in the assembly, as its deliberations continue, members are beginning to use the language of antinomianism to attack each other or to undermine each other's position. Is that because the definition of antinomianism is changing?
That's a great question. I think so. I think as they work through what actually is this thing called antinomianism, as they work out the definition, their own, the members of the assembly's own theological positions come to light in a way that hadn't come to light before. So Thomas Gadiker, for instance, who was one of the most often recorded speakers on the floor of the assembly. So he spoke a lot. His positions on justification and Christ's work become clear only as the issue of antinomianism is debated. And as he begins to talk about his understanding of Christ's work, other members of the assembly say, wait a second, you sound like an antinomian. Please tell us your position on justification. And they even request him to explain what actually he believes on these issues. And if antinomianism weren't a concern, if it hadn't been raised, he probably wouldn't have gotten to that point of explaining his position in that way. So, and this is one point that I make in the book as well. The impact of antinomianism actually was great in relation to the assembly's own theological development, I think, in their own thinking about some of these very important issues, like the imputation of Christ's work, like what exactly does the law play in sanctification, in making a believer holy. I think antinomianism becomes kind of the light that starts a fire in their own thinking through some of these important theological issues.
And it's a fire that never really goes out, does it? Because even a couple of decades later, you've got that famous dispute between Richard Baxter and John Owen, again turning upon this issue of antinomianism and its relationship to the doctrine of the imputed righteousness of Christ. What was your biggest surprise as you worked through this body of research?
Well, there were a lot of surprises along the way. I think one thing that did surprise me actually was the level of diversity at the assembly in so far as the issue of justification by faith, which in historical theology, we kind of think, oh, well, that was decided at the Continental Reformation 100 years previous to this time. Well, we come 100 years later to England and theologians don't agree, and they don't even necessarily have a good working definition of some of these very central theological points. And that to me was surprising, just because of the makeup of the assembly. These are all theologians that many of them had doctorates at this time. Many of them had been ministers for decades. And their understanding of some of these issues was still developing. And I think by the time their confession of faith comes out, they reached, in my understanding, a very beautifully complex and thorough definition of these things. So the chapter on justification, chapter 11, it's incredible. I think it's unmatched in English confessions, in the English language. But it took them time to get there. And that to me was surprising, just the process of kind of forming these theological ideas. So
help us think about this, Whitney, because the final version of the confession is often thought to be a kind of negotiated center. So there's huge variety at Westminster, but the final wording is the text that everyone agrees upon. And sometimes there's an argument around its potential for ambiguity as a consequence. How do you, having studied this and thought carefully about this, how do you read the final text? Is that a text that everyone has signed off on? And if so, is it ambiguous in any way, or is it simply the text of the body within the assembly that was most influential and they were happy to make that text as robust as it possibly could be?
Yes, that that is the question, I think, of Westminster Confession studies, is what is this final version, and is it a consensus document? I tend to think more that it's a document that I would say a vast majority of the assembly was very happy to sign off on. Mm-hmm. As far as the minutes of the debates, they're surprisingly, aside from antinomianism and church government, there wasn't a lot of spirited debate on really many of the other issues at all. Mm-hmm. Of course, church government, there was significant debate. And so that those sections, I think, more represent the majority view that the minority kind of agreed to let go. But I'd say other than those sections, there just wasn't a lot of debate over the rest of the confession. And even with the area of justification, and the issues related to antinomianism, sanctification, the law, once the assembly, I think, worked out in itself some of the theological issues, it seems from the minutes that the sides agreed. And it wasn't just an agree to disagree, but they actually worked through the theological issues to the extent that Thomas Gadaker, for instance, was willing and happy to with the final product. Mm-hmm. So that is an issue of debate among researchers still. Mm-hmm.
Well, I think we're all going to be helped by your work. It's an incredibly illuminating and compelling and convincing book, and I'm sure it's going to make a big impact. What kind of impact do you hope it will make?
Well, I wrote the book out of interest in the subject myself, but I would hope that it would illumine the work of the assembly more for researchers, but also just for even the educated or even the lay person in Church of England and Presbyterian churches. I think it is the heritage of many of churches around the world, the work of the assembly. So I would hope it would be of interest both to historians and theologians and lay people. And I think the work of the assembly was just very important. And it, in my mind, changed church history, changed the history of theology forever with the Confession of Faith and the documents. So if I can help uncover some of that work, I think I've done something that is exciting.
Good. Well, it certainly is exciting. Well, Whitney, we've taken up a lot of your time today, but before we wind up, could you tell us what you're working on at the moment?
Sure. So I am kind of taking the next step with some of the theological issues that I cover in the book. So particularly of interest to me are the debates about justification and Christ's work. And as you've mentioned before, these debates continue. So they continue in England. They get transferred up to Scotland, where the church very passionately debates some of these issues. So right now I'm working on basically taking the next historical step. So looking at these debates extended on into the 1650s, 1660s, and particularly centered on some of these same issues of Christ's work and justification, sanctification. So that's what I'm working on now.
Brilliant. Well, we look forward to seeing that in due course too. But in the meantime, listen, thanks for writing this book, Christ and the Law, Antinomianism at the Westminster Assembly, just published by Reformation Heritage Book at the end of last year. And thanks to you for coming onto the show for talking about it. Thanks for your time.
Thanks very much for having me.
And thanks to everyone else for listening today. I'll see you next time on New Books in Christian Studies, a channel on the New Books Network podcast.